Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com. Hi, I'm Tobias Carlisle. This is the Acquirers Podcast. My special guest today is Tim Travis of TNT Capital Management. When I think about the things that are going on in this market, the things that stand out are value, financials, and options, and there's no better person to speak about them. He'll be coming up right after this.
Tobias Carlisle is the founder and principal of Acquirers Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquirers Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquirers Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquirersfunds.com.
When I think about the signature of this market at the moment, I think it's kind of like maybe a little value resurgence, seeing some life in the financials and lots of option activity. And when I think of those three things, the first person I think of is you. So I'm just kind of interested to get your take, what you see going on in the market right now.
Well, thanks. I mean, to me, it's peak euphoria. You know, the biggest reminder to me, or the biggest commonality, is how it was in 2000, in the late 1990s. I mean, we were both pretty young back then and probably weren't quite as active in the markets, but back then everyone, you know, thought they were market geniuses, and everyone seemed to be doing pretty well, and you'd only hear about the wins, and that's kind of how it seems to me. I mean, people that showed no interest in the market just, you know, a year ago are now all on the AMC train, or they're you know, very big into crypto. And so I think that, you know, that should be a warning that there's immense amounts of euphoria and speculation going on. And so you just want to keep that in the back of mind, in the back of your mind, to make sure that you're making, you know, prudent financial and investment decisions. And so that's kind of where we are. We're really focusing on, okay, individual scenarios, individual securities. How can we structure our positions to best capitalize on that from a risk-adjusted return standpoint? You know, definitely I think value still has a big disconnect between growth, but there's some interesting growth names as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about structuring, because you're a kind of an options expert, and you're a value guy, and so you're one of the few guys who marries those two really nicely together. So let's just talk, for folks who haven't heard you before, can you describe your strategy?
Sure. So definitely we start first and foremost with identifying deeply undervalued securities, whether that's equity, whether it's fixed income. And then what we do is we look, you know, okay, what's the best way to play it? I mean, if we think this stock's likely to double within the next 2 or 3 years, then certainly just owning the stock outright, or I mean, theoretically buying call options would be the most sensible strategy. But perhaps, you know, like now we're a little concerned with the overall market. Valuations are high. You know, you've got the inflationary backdrop. So what we'll also do is we'll look, okay, well, what's the debt trading at? You know, most of that is yielding very paltry returns right now. So then we might look, okay, well, what about selling a put? Selling a put with the willingness to own the stock at a cheaper price. And depending on kind of the returns you can get on those puts and how far away from the current market price, that might be a better risk-adjusted return, particularly because we're not a hedge fund. We are a registered investment advisory, so we're investing for everyday people and making sure that you know, we're prudently doing it. So that could be a good risk-adjusted return, especially in a market like this.
Let's just talk a little bit about the market. So I see it as being very expensive too. And when I saw this statistic yesterday that the spread between the high yield junk bonds and investment grade was as tight as it has been since 2007. So the first thing I thought was, well, I'm going to go and see if I can find some way to play that in the options on like one of the junk bond ETFs or something like that. And I was kind of struck by how much vol there was in all of those positions. It was so expensive to get any of that kind of hedging on that I just passed by. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, because I thought if there's anybody who can take advantage of some of that vol, it'll be you. So are you seeing that in your individual positions?
Yeah. I mean, We've had a great start to the year. Values had held up really well. We're pretty big in financials. We're decently exposed to energy, which obviously both those hurt us last year, but it's helped us really, since early November. And so right now we're looking at it and we see the market as being pretty inflated. And I think there's some major concerns coming up. What's the inflation data going to look like? What's that mean for interest rates? And then also you've got the hangover on spending. I mean, right now we're going to have an amazing summer, hopefully, and you're going to see travel numbers that are insane and everything's booked and prices are sky high. But what does that look like when the stimulus tap is empty? And so I think that when you start looking towards the end of the year and you go into next year's earnings guidance, that could be a little iffy for some of these companies. So we're definitely pretty conservatively structured. And like I'll give you an example. So like one of our investments for the last few years has been Cleveland Cliffs. So iron ore miner. And they've got an amazing CEO. The guy is passionate. He's a little controversial because he's very blunt, which is hard nowadays, of course. And what they did was they bought AK Steel, at pretty distressed levels, and then they bought the U.S. operations of ArcelorMittal. So they went totally vertically integrated. And I mean, goodness gracious, the timing could not have been better. So they took on a lot of debt, but they did this. They also built an HBI plant, which they financed themselves. They didn't do any partners, and now prices are sky high, astronomical. So they're projecting to do, I believe it's $5 billion of EBITDA this year, and I think it might actually end up being higher than that. And the stock's got an enterprise value just over $17 billion. So I mean, we're not stupid. This is going to be close to peak margins this next year or two. They're a huge supplier to the auto market, so steel for the auto industry, that's gangbusters. So the stock here, I mean, it trades at a low multiple. You could easily make the case to buy it. I could see it pulling up on your screens, next year as the earnings come through. But what we're doing is we're selling puts. So I mean, just a month ago, for instance, with the stock trading at like 1950, we were able to sell $10 puts expiring in January of next year for about 71 cents. So $71 per contract. And you look at that, that's just over half a year. You're locking in, like 9% annualized returns. 10% annualized returns roughly. And you're locking that in almost requiring a 50% drop in an already undervalued stock. And you compare that to junk bonds, what 3.8%, and I mean, even the junkiest of junk is barely over that. I mean, the stuff that's likely to default. So for me, that's an attractive risk-adjusted return. I'm happy to own the stock. I've owned it there. For us, I'll take that any day of the week.
Let's just walk through how you come to those numbers. So you get it's a $10 strike on the puts and it's 71 cents. Then you think about that as like $10 minus 71 cents and $9.29.
Yep.
And then you got the 71 cents on the $9.29. That's how you get to almost like a 9%
Yeah,
kind of
total
yield on it.
return. And then when you annualize that, a little bit over half a year from this was about a month ago when this pricing existed. So you annualize that and you're probably in double digits there. And I mean, you really require a 50% drop in the stock just to get to break even. And I mean, what I like about that company specifically is I know the CEO as far as I understand how he operates. So his focus is, he says he wants to be debt free, whether that happens or not. But they're going to use this enormous windfall of EBITDA to dramatically reduce the debt. And so you've got these acquisitions, they're going to have a phenomenal balance sheet. You're going to see those credit ratings keep popping up. And so that's going to de-risk the company a lot. And then if you get in at that lower price, well, that's fine. You know, that's fine. We know it's a cyclical industry, so earnings are going to fluctuate, but they're going to earn a ton of money this year. And I think next year's probably going to be strong too. You know, there still is a lot of demand, particularly if we see some more infrastructure spending. So for fairly conservative investors, like many of my clients are, that's an attractive risk-adjusted return for me. I'd rather do that than buy bonds and take the interest rate risk, spread widening risk, and then ultimately default risk on some of the more speculative stuff.
So some of this sort of dovetails with a conversation on inflation. So when you look at something like steel, which is a cyclical and doing very well, driven perhaps by there's some additional demand for cars, there seems to be something like that going on, right? So you've got this potentially sort of shorter term bump perhaps from the stimulus and COVID, but how do you see that playing out over a longer term? So I guess I'm asking, is it transitory or is it here to stay?
Well, I mean, you tell me. I don't know the answer to it. I mean, to me, I think it feels like real inflation. And if you do study history, which I know you do, inflation was such a dominant aspect of society, you know, in the 70s. I mean, it really was. It was transformational. And those that were around for it, you know, have deeply ingrained memories of it. You know, getting mortgages at the, 11-12%, rate, which is just insane now. I mean, think of what that would do. And so, you know, you have these massively inflationary factors, the money printing. I mean, we're going to Hawaii in September, and oh my gosh, the rental car prices, it's $200 a day for a crappy style car, you know? And of course the hotels and the flights are now ramping up again. So to me, it feels like it's going to be real, but then you do have I feel like there is some deflationary aspects going on. You're likely going to see a tax hike. I think that I'm just not super optimistic on the overall economy long term. You're going to have a big hangover, like we kind of mentioned, with the stimulus, where you know that's going to wear off, and people are going to kind of have dug into their savings, are now maybe going to start using a little bit more leverage. They might get a little more tight-fisted. So I think that's the argument against it. But to me, I'd put the odds. I'm much more worried that inflation will appear. So I think betting on the reflation play is smarter. And the reality is we've been in a low interest rate environment. So things like the banks, look, they're going to be fine. Even if interest rates stay low, they're still going to, I mean, they're not going to get a drastic re-rating higher in multiples, but they're not going to get crushed either. I mean, rates have been low, you know, for the last decade.
So there's some suggestion that inflation is good for value. I don't know how inflation impacts the banks. It probably tends to hurt them. But do you have any view on value and the banks?
Well, I think inflation in general, you know, if it's not like a, you know, hyperinflation or even a super severe. I mean, if you start seeing rates creep up and you get to, you know, 3 or 4% on the 10-year, I think that'd be really a sweet spot for a lot of the banks and also the insurance companies. You know, you're gonna get way more yield. You're gonna see returns on equity lift up pretty significantly, especially because they've had to adopt their operating, costs to this environment. So there'd be some real operating leverage that they could pull from that. If it goes on a lot further, of course it could be bad. But I think I think I'd rather have an inflationary environment for them, particularly. I think. Of all the asset classes, I think energy and commodities probably does best, and financials are pretty strong in that area as well. So,
you've been a long-term follower of Assured Guaranty, ticker's AGO. Can you give us an update on what has happened there, and perhaps start with just an overview of the thesis in AGO?
Yeah. So what it is they're a municipal bond insurance company. They're really the only survivor from the previous bubble back in the financial crisis when almost all of them went bust. And they're the largest. There's one other smaller competitor that's gone on. But so they got through the financial crisis unscathed. They didn't underwrite the CDO squared or any of that garbage, and then they ended up getting reimbursed from a lot of the mortgage and structured finance losses that they did have because of fraudulent rep and warranties from the banks. So the banks had to pay them multi-billion dollar settlements. So they're strong underwriters, strong balance sheet. They're still AA rated. And then they got hit, as things are really starting to pick up, they got hit with Puerto Rico about 5 years ago. And really the hysteria started about 6 years ago. And so that bankruptcy-like situation has been a nightmare. It's taken absolutely forever. The oversight board that was appointed to it has been abysmal. They've spent over $1 billion in legal and consulting costs, but we're finally to the end line. And by the way, between that, they got hit by two hurricanes, including Hurricane Maria, which set things back. And then you have COVID, which basically they lost a year from. But anyways, to make a long story short, we're at the end. So they've come to agreements with all of their exposures where they've actually taken losses on. There's about two or three credits where they haven't taken any losses on, and those will just continue. But so they've got resolutions. Now that they have to be approved in Title III court still, but I honestly don't see a huge problem there. I'm very confident it'll happen. They're also getting a huge amount of stimulus money, Puerto Rico, from the recent legislation that's passed. So the situation looks great. And on the last quarter, management flagged that they're fully reserved. So the Bears, like David Einhorn, they said that they're going to have to add billions in reserves for Puerto Rico. And the math never added up. But it's easy to install fear when you're dealing with like a bond guarantee company, because, you know, you almost always hear about the downside. You don't really hear about the upside when almost all the credits are performing, right? So that situation did not happen. They're fully reserved and they're likely overly capitalized now, maybe up to about $1 billion. So, I mean, this is a, you know, $3.5 billion market cap company roughly. And so you could see a massive buyback. They've been buying back about 400 to 500 million in stock each year. And the stock's been so perennially undervalued that it's enormously accretive. So you've got this strong company, Puerto Rico, the biggest issues resolved. They're going to buy back a ton of stock. It trades, you know, at like $47, $48. It's got a book value of 85. It's got an adjusted book value that'll cross 120 this year. And then you've got, you know, likely all this excess capital freed up because Puerto Rico's resolved. And then you look at municipalities. I mean, this is why the situation's so different. Last year, Toby, I was terrified of municipal finances just because you don't know the government's going to come in like they did. You don't know that they're going to basically bail out all the municipalities like they did. And you don't know that revenues are going to hold up a lot better than what was anticipated. But I mean, look what happened. Revenues did hold up better than anticipated. And then you got, you know, the mother of all stimulus packages for these, you know, municipalities, whether you agree on it or not, whatever, it happened. And so now, I mean, even, you know, formerly troubled credits like Illinois are far less worrisome than they were before. So one more thing I'll mention is, so they're below investment grade credits in their insured portfolio. Obviously those are the ones you're keeping an eye out. They're already the lowest in their history. At least that I'm aware of. So at least 16 years, I'd say 16, 17 years of history. Now, over half of that is related to Puerto Rico. And that's basically resolved. One, pending approval in Title III court. So you're going to have that cut in half already from the lowest level ever. And what's weird is the market just hasn't really picked up on it yet. The stock's moved for sure. You know, it's having a really nice year, but it's, maybe they're doubting it, or maybe not many people are following the name. And so I think that one is one of the opportunities that has a chance to really run, you know, as we go on in this year and going into next year.
When you look at something like AGO, how do you play it? Is that an options? Do you sell options to get in, and or is that just in the equity?
You have so much upside. I mean, it makes sense to own the equity. When we're like dollar cost averaging into things, so I love, you know, staggering options and maybe selling some shorter term ones. If I already own the stock, maybe, all right, if it trades down to 42 in the next 60 days, I'm happy to own some more stock there. And you could always argue against or for that stuff, but I'm a big buyer. I'm sure you are too. I mean, I love dollar cost averaging. I always, you know, am willing to buy the stocks that I own as they drop in price, as long as nothing's fundamentally changed on it. So, but mostly you want to own the equity. That's one of those kind of, I think the upside, when we get the big upside in our portfolio, it'll come from a stock like that, you know, and then you have some of the ancillary names like the Cleveland Cliffs position I told you about, where that's kind of like a fixed income surrogate. It's going to behave differently. I'm not going to say it's the same as a bond, but that's how we look at it, is kind of like a surrogate, a refined strategy to, generate income with a favorable risk-adjusted return.
So we've talked about iron and we've talked about a municipal reinsurer. Let's take a complete left turn and do AT&T.
Sure. So AT&T, I mean, is a stock everyone loves to hate, and I understand why. It's just like GE in some ways, where they made ridiculous acquisitions, and they paid way too much. The bidding war for Time Warner was sickening to watch. So these mistakes have been made, and I understand why people are hesitant on the stock, but I looked at that Discovery deal as truly transformational. And it also tells me that the CEO finally kind of gets it. So, you know, they're getting a reasonable value for the Time Warner assets, and they're combining with Discovery, which I think that they're very complementary products. To me, I would much rather have, you know, Time Warner plus Discovery than Netflix or Amazon Prime Video. I think it's extremely competitive. You have kind of a different balance too between, you know, the dramas, the sitcoms, and then also the kind of home improvement type stuff or the reality TV that's on Discovery. So I think it's a good mix. And then don't forget, AT&T is going to own 71% of that. So you've got, you know, John Malone linked Discovery. My only critique on Discovery is the executive pay is out of control. But you have them, they know how to use free cash flow. They know how to use the capital structure. That's going to be a leveraged bet. And I think they're going to win. I think they'll be a winner. And then you've got the communications business, which is fantastic. And AT&T is going to be able to remove the debt problem. They've already been doing a good job paying off debt, but now, I mean, they're going to dramatically reduce debt. They're going to be able to invest, just focus on having that be a lean operation. And then you got the stock. I mean, it's trading at, you know, less than 10 times forward earnings. It's got a 7.24% dividend roughly. And I mean, that's going to get cut. Okay. So you have a huge amount of sellers that are just, oh, they're cutting the dividend, I'm out, you know? And I understand that people that own it only for the dividend, we're total return investors. That dividend maybe drops to 4.5%, 5%, just depending on the share price. We're still comfortable with that. That beats bonds. And then I think you have a lot of upside. So we'll happily hold the Time Warner Discovery shares we get. And then we'll happily hold the AT&T. So that's, I think, a good investment with not too much risk.
And when you're looking at something like that, is that just a straight equity play, or do you structure something like that too?
Well, that's when it's fun, honestly. I mean, so we do it all. You know, we own the stock, we'll sell calls. There's not a lot of value in calls. I mean, if you're immensely bullish on AT&T, buying calls is like free. You know, it's really, really cheap. I think Mike mentioned that on one of your podcasts not long ago. I think he looked at it and he's right. I mean, so, but you could do some things with like longer dated calls, to generate premium, and then also sell puts behind it. So, you can use the whole assortment of strategies on that one.
And another, complete left turn, Alibaba.
Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of growth at a reasonable price, you know, and you know, obviously the overhang is China, and trust me, I'm not a big fan of investing in Chinese stocks. I don't like what's going on there. I'm worried about the Taiwan situation. I don't like what happened at that lab. So I have a lot of concerns about that, but you know, it's an investment, and it does trade cheaply. I mean, it's a high teens multiple on forward earnings, and I mean they're growing robustly. They've got all the assets. You know, they've got good competition with JD and with Tencent, but I think they're poised to win, and I think they've resolved the worst part of the regulatory environment. So it's not something I'm going to bet huge in, but I think it's a good play for growth at a reasonable price, kind of like the FANGs were, you know, last year, or, you know, when they got a little bit cheap, they were good growth at a reasonable price. And I think if you're going to buy a Baidu or a Alibaba, you know, now probably is not a bad time to get in.
And again, in something like that, equity, or you try to structure something like that?
Equity and then selling puts. So I mean, I like the upside. So that's one of those where if it hits, you know, I'm willing to hold for a long time, you know, and let it run, because I mean, it's such a nice growth play. But yeah, there's good premium in the equity. But you want to structure that from a position size standpoint with what you're comfortable losing, because there is a lot of risk with the regulatory environment. And then also what happened, I mean, like with China Mobile, when they got delisted, you know, we own that. We own some of that. And you know, we had to end up selling at a way discounted price than it should have been. I mean, that's a very valuable company, of course, and the valuation was fantastic. So you never know about those type of things. But also, I mean, that stuff can happen in the U.S. too. I mean, the recent Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac decision in the Supreme Court, to me, was an abomination. So it's not like you can't get those types of issues that change the game for you here either.
And probably right back in your wheelhouse with Credit Suisse.
Yeah. So there, I mean, financials, you know, we were not involved with Credit Suisse until they, you know, got involved with the Archegos blow up, and then the Greensill one, I believe that's how you pronounce it. And so, you know, the stock dropped materially. And what I've liked about Credit Suisse for a while is their wealth management business. So, you know, recurring revenue. And that's been their focus for quite some time. And they're very good at it. I mean, just like UBS. And you look at UBS, they trade at a very high multiple. UBS kind of downsized their investment bank where earnings are more volatile. Credit Suisse was really doing the same thing, but obviously they had a poor risk management, and some people were being way too aggressive, and management's definitely, you know, to blame there as well. You know, they got hit. They barely took a loss as far as the total company, because the other businesses were operating so well and hitting on all cylinders. So it's not like it really impaired their capital or anything. So as we emerge out of this, okay, sure, you're going to have some employees leave that are going to be bummed because their bonuses are going to be down, but you're still going to have that wealth management business. You're still going to have a very competitive investment bank. And now the difference is we're getting it at, you know, 60% of tangible book value in a great investment banking environment, a great wealth management environment. I just don't see us losing on a long-term basis on that. It's not a structurally impaired company like perhaps Deutsche Bank was. That, like, Deutsche Bank after the financial crisis, where they actually did well, they came out of that structurally impaired because they were just all in on fixed income trading, and that business didn't return really until last year on all cylinders. So now they're doing a little bit better again. But this is like, they, you know, they're in the right businesses, the right markets. They just had some, you know, one-off events that are really bad, but I think that they're correctable.
You run a very eclectic portfolio across lots of different industries and, you know, across different security types. How do you find these opportunities? What's your sort of search process?
Well, I think I'm different than most investment advisors in that I'm reading all day. So I don't golf, I don't do any marketing. I'm not, I'm not prospecting like that. So the way that we get clients is by putting out research, and putting out content. And so I think, just like you, Toby, I mean, that's one reason why I think we've hit it off a long time ago is that you and I are both like students of history. We read. So you develop that collection of businesses and industries that you understand, and you're constantly growing that, and you have to know what your limits are and what your strengths are and work within those confines. So it's really just that. It's di time. I mean, this will be our 10th year in operation at TNT Capital Management, and then 20 almost 20 years in the industry for me. So it's just time and focus, really.
And then when you find these opportunities, what's your validation process? How are you proving it up? Because I know you've spoken to AGO's management and Dom Federico. You know them pretty well, have known them for a long time. So is that an unusual sort of step?
I do like getting involved with management as far as just getting a feel for them. And sometimes, I mean, look, they're not always going to talk to you depending on your size or whatever. And it just depends on who they are. Honestly, I feel like the companies that I've done better in the past, management has at least been willing to, have a phone call and just get to know each other and just to get a feel for how they operate as managers. And companies I've had less success with are extremely resistant and will only talk to the BlackRocks of the world. So that's part of it. I like to at least study their history, even if I can't talk to them. Really see what they did in the past, and how they acted. Capital allocation's a big deal. So if I understand the capital allocation strategy, I feel good. Bad acquisitions are kind of like my pet peeve. It blows up so much shareholder value. Like we saw with AT&T, we saw with GE in the past and so many other companies, and we'll keep seeing that. So
Does anybody allocate capital better than AGO?
they're pretty good at it. I mean, I like it, but truthfully, they don't really have that many great opportunities because the bond insurance business has slowed down since the financial crisis. It's starting to pick back up, but that's one that's rate sensitive. So if you get higher rates, you're going to see geometric growth in underwriting premium, and then it makes more sense to keep a little more capital. But because the portfolio has been amortizing, they have excess capital. You have an undervalued price, and he's smart enough to take advantage of it. And what I like about him is if you remember Dom, if you remember last year, so many CEOs, like during the peak of the panic, they were like, okay, we're going to stop buying back stock. And I get it. There's some politics involved, but if you really believe your company is fully reserved and in strong financial condition and can weather the storm, and now your stock is trading 50% lower, buy back all you can. And I mean they did. I mean the stock dropped a lot, like almost all financials, and it really got crushed, and they bought back hand over fist, and it created enormous, shareholder value, and now they're in a great position.
When you're, we were speaking a little bit before about rebalancing. So you definitely buy as something's going against you a little bit to take advantage of those lower prices. But when you think about constructing the portfolio, how do you think about sizing positions?
Yeah, I mean, so we're always going to allocate the most to our best ideas. So there's not like a 5% rule where you're going to have 20 positions at 5% or anything like that. We'll definitely do the biggest positions on our best ideas. And then, we'll build into, one's other positions with options. So it's like, okay, well, if Cleveland Cliffs goes lower, it might go from a, 2% position to a 5% position, with getting exercised on options, but that's at our price. So it's just basically a synthetic way of dollar cost averaging on the shares. So it's structured like that.
And how do you think about sizing the options positions? You're always thinking as a the nominal position is capped at some 2 or 5% sort of holding?
I'd say we're fairly agnostic. I mean, I don't really care if we're using options in the way that we use them. Keep in mind, we're not buying options. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think that the odds are more in your favor with selling options. So we're pretty agnostic. We just want the best risk-adjusted return. But in this market environment, I'm not optimistic on the next 3 to 5 years on equities at all. You know, I'm very bearish, I'd say. Not John Hussman bearish, but I'm bearish. And normally I'm very optimistic. And so what I want to do is I want to take, okay, I've got a few bets that I think the odds are stacked in my favor where there's a lot of upside. Like you could get a double on an AGO easily, or 50% in a year. Like that's very possible, you know, from current levels, and it would still be undervalued. But then with the rest of the market, I'm, you know, look, if you tell me I could get 7% a year over the next three years, like I would probably be comfortable with that. Like I'd be comfortable with that, with where the valuations are. And one thing I was thinking before our call was, you know, I was looking at 2000 because, you know, it's a great analogy for the president. I mean, the 10-year treasury was about 6.5%. And imagine that. You're a money manager too. You know, I mean, imagine 6.5% with, you know, no credit risk versus, you know, where we're at with multiples here. You know, it's an interesting conversation to have.
And that's 6.5%. That's a nice hedge too, because if you get some sort of market volatility, it's likely that there's a flight to that. And so you get some rally in your holdings. Whereas
Exactly. It's a huge hedge. And also, I mean, yeah, it's stunning to think about that. And I mean, that's why this is the everything bubble. Real estate, it's hard to find asset classes that aren't in a bubble right now.
Yeah, I watched the 10-year pretty closely because I think it's a reasonable proxy for not the performance of value, but as the 10-year seems to creep up, value seems to do a little bit better, and vice versa. As the 10-year fades, value seems to do a little bit worse. And so I've watched it over the last, you know, it got crushed through March 2020, so last year. And then at the start of this year, it started rallying, and that seemed to coincide with value doing better. And then over the last sort of couple of months, we've seen it soften up a fair bit.
Yeah,
I have no idea what drives it, but it is one of the things that I watch reasonably closely. I think that there's some cap though. There's some point at which the Federal Reserve can't let it float up too much, because it then impacts the borrowing of the federal government. Do you have any view on that?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree. I think, but that's why inflation's the most significant thing, for sure. So, the Fed can, you know, keep buying bonds. I mean, I was thinking, okay, Kyle, I don't know if you saw it this morning, but Kyle Bass brought up China and the likely aggressiveness that they're going to show for Taiwan over the next few years. I mean, that's a huge situation that is going to involve, I mean, that's a major risk that's out there. And so let's say China stops buying US treasuries for some reason. Maybe they can do that, maybe they can't. It doesn't matter. But the Fed can keep printing money and buying treasuries, of course. But what if you have inflation? So, I mean, if you have inflation that just keeps picking up and inflation expectations pick up, well, then those longer dated bonds are going to start yielding a lot more. You know, the market's going to move those. And so it's inflation that will ultimately drive the Fed long term. And so that's why by far and away, that's the most important thing to watch. And just like you said, the 10-year treasury has been driving value and growth. And, you know, I mean, imagine what a 4% 10-year treasury was normal, you know, a decade ago. You know, anything close to that level now, what happens to the multiples of some of these glamour stocks? You know, I read an article today. Someone was saying that 13 times sales is cheap. You know, and of course, I'm sure you remember the Sun Microsystems CEO letter where he was talking about what expectations are implied with 10 times sales. So now 13 times sales are cheap for a great company like a PayPal.
Yeah, I got called a boomer for pointing out that Sun Microsystems. That quote where he said it's like a 10 times sales, you get And he had to, that doesn't account for any of the costs of running the business, which just seems crazy. But now that 10 times sales, for that's reasonably cheap for a growth stock.
It really is. I mean, it's night and day difference. And I mean, these are great businesses. I mean, that's one difference, and everyone will flag it. I mean, Amazon, honestly, I don't look at like Amazon as, okay, well, this is a massive bubble. I don't look at Apple that way, or most of them. I mean, Facebook was cheap, you know, it's getting a little more expensive lately. But I think, you know, some of those other ones, and you know, you look at kind of the tricks that they do with the accounting and the stock issuance, you know, there's a lot of signs of speculation. And obviously you can see that in crypto and all that too.
Yeah, I think that the, funnily enough, those big tech, those older big tech like Facebook, Apple, Google, have all been, they're expensive, but they're reasonable for what they are. They're really great businesses. There's the other stuff, I think, is the more egregious valuations, where they're all kind of priced as if they are going to be an Amazon. And the math just doesn't check out when you look at where they have to get to over, you know, the next 10 or 20 years to justify those valuations. It's just that they have to get too big. It's not possible.
No, I'd agree. And that's why something as boring as an AT&T, you know, you're getting a really nice dividend. You've got upside. You've got this, you know, the shareholders own 71% of the combined Discovery, Time Warner's, which is going to be a very formidable streamer. You know, so something like that to someone like me is sensible. I don't want to get blown up by that chaos. Cause I mean, think about it. All you had to do was buy Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and they all react quite a bit to the interest rates. You know, if you start seeing selling pressure on those, whether it's warranted or not warranted, I mean, you really could see a cascade. And of course those other names will follow, the more overvalued ones. So I think that there's risk there.
Given the backdrop of that overvaluation and there not being a lot of great opportunities in anything that's not a traditional hedge, but like the 10-year or something like that, do you, and I know that you don't like buying options. So how do you carry cash? What do you do in that sort of scenario?
I mean, I carry cash, and I also think about what I would do. So, okay, like what do I do when the market crashes? I buy stock. So when I'm selling a put at, you know, such a massive discount to the current price, you're going to get jacked on volatility. So like that put that we sold for 71 cents, you know, a month ago or whatever, that could go to, you know, that could double in price. It could triple in price theoretically, you know, if the stock tanks with the overall market and you see volatility go up. But what matters to me is, look, the decision I made was I'm willing to buy Cliffs at $10. You know, that's fine. I valued the company. I think they'd have a lot of upside from there. The balance sheet's going to be good. So that's it. So all I do is I you have to weather the volatility storm. And this is something where if you're managing other people's money, you have to educate your clients on this, because that is, you know, that is the hard part. You're taking volatility hits. You know, you're not benefiting like you are buying options and doing that. But once you educate them and kind of, you know, show, okay, look, once this option expires, volatility goes to zero, time goes to zero. The only thing that matters is where the stock price at. And then I definitely keep cash too. I mean, you don't want to be 100% invested, I think, in this market. I think you're going to have better buying opportunities.
Do you find a lot of people who are coming to you right now with a pool of cash and saying, help me get invested? So what do you do with someone like that?
Well, the options are a great way. And just focusing on valuations. I mean, there's definitely names that we like an AGO. So that's a great way, because it's just, you know, you're not going 100% in at the market at these levels. We've got some people that, you know, did really well last year. And then they, you know, like people that are coming to us now, they did really well with like the ARK type stuff. And then they got burnt pretty bad when that stuff started trailing, you know, in the first quarter. And I think they see that, okay, well, growth has had a great run. Values, you know, still really undervalued. We're just in the early innings of what could potentially be a big run. And so I think that there are some people that are realizing that. And I think that there could be a lot of momentum towards value if that tenure continues to creep higher.
Yeah. Any view on what that's going to do?
Yeah, I think it goes higher. I really do. I think barring, you know, I mean, it's always alarming, honestly, because you have like all the fears about the variants and stuff like that. Which I definitely, I don't think that there's reason to be very fearful of it. So you don't know what kind of the government's going to do. But I do think that you're going to see inflation. People want to live, people want to travel. People are spending a lot of money on their houses. Everything's expensive. I don't see these restaurants and things like that. They're not going to be able to pull back prices. They're not going to pull back or, you know, all these, higher salaries that people are having to pay, you know, people aren't going to accept pay cuts at those companies. So I think inflation will last, would be my gut.
I saw a tweet from Jim Chanos yesterday where he pointed out that the yield on the high yield index is now below inflation, which is kind of an extraordinary event to see in this market. So I'm with you. I don't see how it stays where it is, but I've been sort of shocked that it's backed off from what is a historically a very low level. I think it might have got to 1.7 or something like that, which if you run that chart back as far as you can, there's nothing anywhere as low as that other than sort of the last 12 months. And yeah. So I've been sort of shocked that it's run backwards, particularly given what inflation is doing. But I guess that's the question then, is it transitory? Is it here to stay? And I guess there's this short-term view over the last few months that it's transitory.
Yeah. I mean, the Fed's doing a good sales job on it, at least. And I mean, they're still buying back so much. I mean, imagine if they're not buying back debt, you know, what happens with that 10-year? It's a completely manipulated market, and they've gotten away with it until inflation. So if inflation will be the biggest determinant over the next 10 years on what's successful from an investment perspective. Well, I mean, bonds, imagine bonds with inflation. And there's trillions of dollars allocated to bonds, even at negative yields. So it's hard to imagine the carnage that would emerge from that. So it's, you know, think about it when we're structuring our portfolios.
Tim, it's a fascinating discussion. We're coming up on time. If folks want to get in contact with you, what's the best way of doing that?
Sure. Just our website, ttvalueinvesting.com, and all our contact info's on there. And we also have a blog that's on there that they can follow as well. So that's usually the best way.
I'll link that up in the show notes. Tim Travis, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Toby. Appreciate it, man.